Doug Peacock grew up roaming the forests and swamps of Michigan, fishing for trout and exploring the encampments of ancient people along the beaches of the Great Lakes. He graduated from Arthur Hill High School and the University of Michigan. Later, he entered the military, served 2 years as a Special Forces medic in the Central Highlands of Vietnam. After the war, Doug returned to the mountains of the American West and found the solitude he needed to confront the demons of war. In his first book, Grizzly Years, Doug credits grizzly bears with restoring his soul. In the last 3 decades, he has lectured and written widely about the wilderness and traveled to the few remaining wild places on the planet. And Doug, you're on the phone. Hello.
Yeah, Aaron, it's great to be talking to you.
Good talking to you, Doug. Today we're going to be talking about your newest book, In the Shadows of the Sabretooth, but what I'd like to do for our listeners is talk about a lot of your other books, too, so they have a better sense of what you've done. And we'll probably start by talking about the first book, Grizzly Years. Near the beginning of the book, you explain that after 2 years in the Central Highlands, much of it in combat, your tour of duty ended, and a few days later, you were standing on the tarmac at Tri-City Airport in Saginaw. Which is,
I remember.
just an amazing kind of thing. And with all the physical and psychological wounds that are common to returning warriors, during your deployment, you carried a map of Montana and Wyoming and a flint spearhead. There was always a sense that you knew where you were going, wasn't there?
Yeah, that I call it the roadmap, and I carried it throughout my medical training back in the States all the way to Vietnam. And it was just a little roadmap of Wyoming and Montana, and I would suffer a bottomless homesickness for the mountains and the wilderness, the Rocky Mountains, and. And so in my mind, I'd break up my little map and just stare at it. And I'd especially the blank spots on the map around the Wind River Range or Yellowstone Park or up in above Marshall, further north in Montana. And that arrowhead or spearhead came from the Shiawassee River, not far from Saginaw, where I went to high school. And a friend gave it to me. And it was my talisman. It protected me from any enemy bullets. I mean, towards the end of Vietnam, I got very tired and careless, and I was like a ghost dancer. I mean, literally, I would kind of waltz around during firefights, and I never got hit, or not during those days anyway. And I owed all to that arrowhead. The arrowhead kept me alive, and the map showed me what I wanted to stay alive for.
Well, the book, Grizzly Years, is just such an amazing study of that time in your life, finding your way back to the wilderness. And in the first part of the book, there are these flashbacks that are some of the most chilling writing I've ever confronted. It reminds me a lot of the inner chapters in Hemingway's collected short stories.
Sure.
And I wonder if you'd maybe read one of those for us.
I recorded one of these flashbacks. So this is from Vietnam. It's just a little story. And I was a Green Beret medic. And for the most part, we did our own patrols, meaning, you know, two Americans would go out with about 20, 25 mountain yards or ethnic Vietnamese sometimes. But occasionally we were attached as a point platoon for a big outfit like the 1st Cavalry or the 101st Airborne. And here's the story. We walked point for the 101st Airborne during the summer of 1967. The operation centered on the country just north of the village of Ba'an on the Song Tra and Quang Nai province. I was the only American Green Beret with our point platoon of mixed Vietnamese and mountaineered troops out of our A camp at Bateau. Behind us were 3 platoons of U.S. paratroopers. The operation was not going well. Each unit had taken casualties. We had lost a platoon leader the night before. He caught a carbine round through his head, just under and behind his eyes, which paralyzed his respiratory system. Well, I was keeping him alive by giving him mouth-to-mouth. The Americans mistakenly called gunships in and our position. I was the only one in the point platoon who spoke English, and by the time I could call off the airstrike, we had two more wounded. The platoon leader died while I was screaming, "Stop!" on the radio. The next morning, we led out into the rice paddies, walking along the low dikes. There were half a dozen water buffaloes near the far side, but no people, except one 9 or 10-year-old boy in shorts. The boy might have been tending the buffalo. We walked across the paddy without incident. The airborne troops of the 101st followed closely behind. The boy stood in the rice paddy 30 meters away, watching me and the 20 regulars as we walked by. But when the boy saw the Americans, he ran. Why he decided to run, I would never know. But when he did, the Americans opened up on him. First one or two, then an entire platoon, tearing chunks off his small body with M16 rounds. My people watched, silent and grim-faced.
And that's that kind of thing is often found throughout, especially the first quarter of grizzly years.
Yeah, it mapped my own progress with dealing with the war. When I first came back, first couple of years of war was so close behind it. It could dominate, you know, entire weeks of my life. I'll just read the next paragraph to give you an idea of what went on. The truth was that any last vestige of religion had been choked out of me during the last 2 months in Vietnam by scenes of dead children. To this day, I cannot bear the image of a single dead child. In the years that followed, I had found it easier to talk to bears and priests. I had no talent for re-entering society. Others of my generation marched and expanded their consciousness. I retreated to the woods and pushed my mind towards sleep with cheap wine. And, the grizzly bears ended up being exactly what I needed because, you know, the self-indulgence is just utterly impossible in grizzly country because there's something out there that any time that it chooses, if it wants to, can kill and eat you. And, you're right in the middle of the food pyramid when you're dealing with grizzly bears. You don't walk down a trail thinking about your girlfriend or your portfolio. You know, you're tuned to the air, you scent the breeze, you listen to the birds, you know, your sense of hearing and smelling, that's in, you know, incredible senses that they grow rusty in our urban lives. But out in grizzly bear country, I really retrained those senses, and it's amazing. What, you know, there's a total world out there, and, you know, the bears... The bears dominate the ambience of the place. You know, if you've got a grizzly bear there, your place in this hierarchy of animals is no longer at the top, and you think differently, and it opens you up, and it's sort of an enforced humility. And I found for me that that was the most important thing I needed. The last thing I needed was self-indulgence.
Yes.
And humility was really the emotional posture behind reason, and the bears did it for me.
Well, the book, which is a memoir, has a really interesting arc because it starts out talking about grizzly bears, and you meet them, you can identify them, you go back to them year after year, and then you become an expert in grizzly bears, and then you become an advocate for grizzly bears and for... ecology. It's such an interesting, the whole way the book turns is so interesting.
Well, they in a real way saved my life. And I was out in Yellowstone when they closed the dumps, and bears really had a hard time. They got weaned really quickly off garbage, which they've been eating for 80 years. They went into town site and campgrounds, and towns and governments and managers killed about 270 grizzlies in Yellowstone in a five-year period. And I was in the backcountry, this wacko vet just camping out, but I wasn't blind. And I could see the bears were going away. They were having a hard time. And, you know, it was payback. If they'd saved my life, the least I could do is, you know, do my very best to advertise their plight. You know, that made me into a filmmaker, and inadvertently, I became a writer.
And you became a terrific writer. We are so lucky to have 5 books now from you.
Yeah, I would have started earlier. I didn't know you could just, you know, be a writer. I thought, I lived all my life, as you know, reading voraciously. And my close friends, even after the war, were, you know, writers of note like Edward Abbey and other people. But I guess I thought it was some kind of special club and you needed a key. And when my daughter was born, I always liked to write, but I never thought about actually doing a book until somebody offered me, you know, money, and my baby girl needed shoes, you know, and I sat down at a fire lookout in Glacier National Park, surrounded by grizzlies, with my baby daughter in my lap, you know, with my dad's old Corolla, with a carbon copy, and I started to type out the story of Grizzly Years, and it went so fast, and I enjoyed it so much. I was almost 40 years old by then, and you know, I'd never dreamed of, it just never occurred to me one could just sit down and tell the story of your life, and enjoy it so much.
Well, the interesting thing about Grizzly Years is, many years later, you pick up this memoir again with your 4th book, Walking It Off.
Yes, I owed that book to Edward Abbey, and I owed it to the veterans of all the wars. It took me a long time to let it go because, again, you know, a memoir about my life when my life was changing and, you know, dissolving and wandering, you know, became homeless and divorced I was really a lost soul. And the book encompasses that period of my life, you know, and I support myself by then by, you know, taking trips to, you know, to rather remote wild places, rather than in Siberia where the tigers are, up to the Arctic with polar bears. And I'd write magazine articles. So, you know, I was a writer all that time, but I knew I wanted to tell a larger story I called it a happy book about death. I went over to the Himalayas, and
that's where the book opens.
Yeah, and I just buried my friend Edward Abbey. Ed died of bleeding esophageal varices. You know, those are the veins in your throat under a condition called portal hypertension. They can grow very large and thin, and you can lose, like, you know, I'm a medic and I've worked in hospitals, so you know, I've seen people lose 20 units of blood in 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. It's really quick. Ed died of that. Well, I had climbed over a pass. I keep thinking it's 19,000, but anyway, it was the highest I'd ever been. But you know, to this wild valley that's about 16,000 feet, and I had a dry cough, and I indulged it one night and ripped a tear in my throat, and I bled out a couple quarts of blood up there in the middle of no place. I was with 2 Americans, or a British climber and an American biologist, but there's no way in hell I was going to get out of there, and because I thought I had exactly what Ed Abbey had. You know, esophageal varices, that's a terminal condition. About half of people with that symptom die within 6 months, and I thought, well, you know, that's me, and I'm going to die, and there's no way I'm going to get over that path. So that's how the book started out. It was having about second chances, because I did make it over that path. The condition in my throat was a mechanical tear, not a terminal condition, and so I got a second chance at life. And, you know, I saw my children, and the first thing I did was go up to Glacier Park and hike up to a place called the Grizzly Hilton by myself. And it was a landscape I never thought I would glimpse again. And it was just magic. It was so sensate. I could smell, you know, every everything, every fungus on along the trail. I could hear the rustle of every leaf on all of the underbrush, and the bears were there. And I did that book because a friend read it on his deathbed, and he read the manuscript, and he made me promise. He said, "Doug, you've got to publish this." I had 600 pages, and I was able to let 200 pages or a little more go. You know, I'm still sitting on the rest of that.
Your newest book is going in a very different direction. In the Shadow of the Sabretooth, and I'll read the continuation of the title, a renegade naturalist considers global warming, the first Americans, and the terrible beasts of the Pleistocene. Wow. One of the things that intrigued me early on was that I could just see you so completely. There you were standing at the top of North and South America before it was inhabited by our species, sort of seeing the great adventure.
Lordy, I can't imagine a greater adventure. I mean, here, and I'm talking about, 15,000 years ago, for a person like myself who loves wilderness and exploration, think of that one. Standing somewhere in Alaska looking south, realizing there are no smokes on the horizon, there's no footprints of human beings, and you have two entire uninhabited by human continents waiting for you, five times the land mass of Australia, completely wild and teeming with, great and terrible beasts of the Pleistocene, many, capable of snaring and eating a human being, and including creatures humans had never seen before until they crossed the Bering Straits and got into North America, like the gigantic short-faced bear that was, roughly twice as big as a grizzly, stood 7 foot at the hip joint.
It's an interesting book because it supposedly is about global warming, but that's only mentioned in the last chapter. But you go back to the last time there was global warming that allowed humankind to.
That's how I did it. And the cardinal issue of my generation is the collective damage we've dealt Mother Earth, and now that is clearly manifest by global warming. But it's a bummer story. I don't bear any good news, and this is something I follow very carefully. I'm starting a project up on the north slope of the Yukon this summer. Polar bears are coming south because there's no more summer sea ice for them to hunt upon and off. Grizzly bears are, trucking north following, the phenology of grasses as species march north. They're running into each other. They're interbreeding, But I had no good news, and it's a bummer story. I didn't want to write a bummer book, so I thought about it. The question I asked myself, have humans ever, in the history of our species, have we ever encountered a global warming? Our species has only been on Earth for a couple hundred thousand years, and we've only been out of Africa maybe 70,000 years or so. But the fact is, we have experienced a global warming, and that one was right here in North America. It started almost 15,000 years ago when, the great glaciers that had closed off North America, from the ice sheets across northern Canada, from the east, the Laurentian Sheet, and then the great glaciers of the western Cordillera coalesced, and there's no way down. Well, that started to change about 14.7 thousand years ago. It started to warm up. The glaciers started to melt. First successful colonization of North America was 13,000 years ago. The Clovis people showed up. They hunted mammoth and mastodons. I think they specialized in mammoth. They only lasted about 250, maybe 300 years. And all of a sudden, the Clovis disappear, and the great megafauna of North America, the Pleistocene megafauna, you know, all the mammoths and mastodons and saber-toothed tigers, they go extinct. And it's like in a heartbeat. I mean, it's so abrupt and staggering. And, you know, the causes of that extinction are still debated. But, you know, what is clear is that human activity combined with global warming is a timeless, deadly formula for extinction, whether it's 13,000 years ago or today. And those are the kind of connections, you know, I was looking for. At every plausible turn of the trail, you know, I was looking at something that, you know, applied to modern-day global warming, which is, you know, which has a lot to do with the perception of risk. Because we evolved to deal with things like saber-toothed tigers crouching in the bush and not this much more deadly threat, which, you know, they call climate change, but it's really global warming. And it's happening, and you know, it's unlike the saber tooth. This is something which we think, at least, is happening, you know, incrementally to remote strangers, but that's really not true. It's really happening right now, right in your front or backyard, no matter where you are.
So since I've gotten an advanced copy of this book, the title has been changed. Could you give it to our listeners, please?
The title is In the Shadow of the Sabertooth. The subtitle is Global Warming, The Origins of the First Americans, and the Terrible Beast of the Pleistocene.
Now, you have a very informative website.
It's Doug Peacock, one word, .net. All of my writings and blogs and books and travels to far places with a, you know, with a special preference for dangerous animals is you can find those things on the site, and it's dougpeacock.net.
Well, thank you so much for this interview. Greatly appreciated.
A great pleasure and a privilege to talk to you.
Thank you.